The third group was the Socialist Party of North America. And probably if you wrote an account of the left in Canada in 1918, you would have left them out. Because they were small, probably about 100 members, right? In terms of the time, they were tiny. They were only organized in southern Ontario, mainly in Toronto, but in a few other cities in southern Ontario. And they made the Socialist Party of Canada look non-sectarian and non-dogmatic and wide open. The Socialist Party of North America is basic, fundamental rule, we do not cooperate with anybody who doesn't agree with us entirely. And that was literally written into their constitution, not in those words. And if you're in the left today, this was the group that showed up at every meeting in order to disagree with everybody. And then to go out and back and write a letter or a leaflet about why everything that happened there was wrong. And they did that over and over again. The reason they're significant is that earlier than the other two and more profoundly than the other two, they radically changed. This was the first group to say, the Bolsheviks have got something. So that's why they're important. So the first factor that led to the creation of the Communist Party was that there was an existing left. And it's quite substantial. The second factor was the Russian Revolution. This is very hard, I think, for us to think. When you're looking back 80, 85, 90 years, it's hard to realize how profound that feeling was. Some of you of my generation will remember the impact of the Cuban Revolution. Suddenly, there was a revolution in the Western Hemisphere. It wasn't only in countries way away. It was close by. Remember, there used to be a great button that said, cheer up, they're only 90 miles away. The culmination of that and the revolutionary struggle in Vietnam were just huge impacts on my generation. Well, the impact of the Russian Revolution makes that pale by comparison. The Canadian left had been badly hit by World War I. Most of the Canadian parties officially opposed the war, but they lost members, a lot of members, who either dropped out, couldn't take the political pressure when there was a lot of attack. Anyway, you opposing the war, if you didn't get arrested, you'd probably get beaten up. And the left went into serious decline for the early part of the years, early part of the war years. Suddenly in 1917, November 7th by our calendar, October 25th by the Russian calendar, theory became reality. Suddenly, instead of just talking about a workers' government that would end capitalism, the Russian revolutionaries were building a workers' government that was going to end capitalism. And that was a huge, huge thing. It's just really hard, I think, to get our minds around how much they were shaken, but every single reminiscence, every single thing I've ever seen written down, every old socialist I managed to talk to in writing the book, and there weren't many still alive even when I wrote the book, said the same thing. And it didn't matter whether they're the British Labour Party type or the Socialist Party of North America type, they were all affected the same way. Malcolm Bruce, in 1917, was a member of the Socialist Party here in Vancouver. And one of my most prized possessions is some reminiscences that he left. And he wrote, "It was like a bolt out of the blue, like a blinding light, when the news came of the overthrow of the government by the Bolsheviks and the establishment of the Soviet Republic. There was a great uplift amongst the working classes. They saw that the working class rose in their might and took over the power of a powerful nation, and they wondered if it couldn't be done here. Charlie Lester, who was perhaps the greatest lecturer and propagandist they had in the Socialist Party, said, 'Malcolm, this is it! This is the beginning of the world revolution.'" There were mass meetings and rallies in solidarity with the Russian Revolution everywhere in Canada. Churches had sermons about it. Even the most Trotsky's, the Bolsheviks the Bolsheviki and World Peace, that's right. First book to get large-scale circulation from the Bolshevik leaders. First one to get wide circulation in Canada. It was reviewed everywhere from Forward, which was a socialist publication, to the Mail and Empire. The most right-wing of ultra-Tory papers, the kind of paper that makes the National Post look socialist. Everybody was enthralled by it, and the left was revitalized. The left now could say, we didn't know how it was going to happen, now we got an example to follow. So that was factor number two, a huge international event. And the third big factor was the gigantic labor upsurge of 1919. Once again, it's hard to remember what it was like, but you know, the population of Canada has grown an awful lot since then. There has never been a year since 1919 when as big a percentage of the working class went on strike. We have never had another year since 1919 as big. We've had years with more workers on strike because we got way more people and more workers organized. But as a percentage of the industrial working class, we've never come close. Everybody knows, has heard about the Winnipeg General Strike, or at least we all think we have. 35,000 people in the city of Winnipeg went on strike, which means, add in their families, they represented the majority of the city. And although the strike's demands itself were fairly limited, the implications of the event were profound. Because what you had was suddenly a city that where nothing moved if the workers' strike committee didn't say it could. The cops went on strike. The strike committee said, no, we think we need some. Go back, guys. And you got permission to work. The milk trucks went around with signs by permission of the strike committee. It was not, I don't want to exaggerate it, it was not that there was an alternative government, but there was pretty close to one. An astounding event. Now, Winnipeg is deservedly remembered as the most important of the labor actions of 1919, but it wasn't the only one, and that's one of the things that gets missed in a lot of accounts, because actually 1919 was a year of extraordinary labor activity from coast to coast. Workers across the country supported the Winnipeg strike, and they also struck for their own objectives. Here in Vancouver, there were actually 60,000 people went out on a general strike at the same time. A smaller percentage of the population, because Winnipeg was a smaller city, but a bigger strike in terms of number of people. There was a general strike in Toronto. There was a general strike in Port Arthur. There was a strike in little towns. There were mass demonstrations in solidarity with Winnipeg in Montreal, which you know, at the time was generally viewed, you know, reactionary, Catholic, backward place. Most of the leaders of these strikes were members of either the Socialist Party or the Social Democratic Party. Now, this wave of strikes, and the Winnipeg General Strike in particular, these were heroic, but they failed. Without exception, they failed. And the leaders of the strikes simply did not live up to the challenge of strikes that were shaking society. They really never got beyond thinking, well, this is a good strike. And thinking in Winnipeg, even in terms of preparing the strikers for the possibility that they might get gunned down. Nobody, you know, we're going to have peaceful marches, and they assumed that they would be able to do it. And this is despite the fact that they were members of Marxist parties and socialist parties. And what a lot of those people drew a conclusion out of this. You know, they were in favor of socialism and they were in favor of militant labor action, but they had no idea how the two related to each other. They had no strategy, they had no tactics. Their socialism was abstract. Talk about we're going to have socialism. And their militant labor activity was something separate in another category. They didn't relate them to each other. They didn't have a program. They didn't have a strategy. They didn't have an organization. As parties, the Socialist Party and the Social Democratic Party played virtually no role. Members of those parties played heroic roles, but as parties they did very little. The defeat of the strikes of 1919 led to an enormous wave of introspection in the left, in the labor left in particular. And by the middle of the 1920s, many of the strike leaders had concluded that the real problem was they hadn't built a party, a Bolshevik party like the Russians. And many of them formed or joined local communist groups. If you're looking for the washroom, it's around here. We should have pointed that out earlier. sorry about that. And so there were local communist groups that got set up in almost every city and town in Canada. This produced an odd result because in the United States, where the original formation of the communist movement was extraordinarily factionalized, the original Communist Party formed and immediately split in two. Then they had a unity convention and immediately split on different lines into two parties. So you had two really hostile to each other communist parties in the United States. Well, in Canada, we didn't have that exactly. But what you had was everybody who wanted to be a communist joined whichever group they came across first, and they'd be affiliated to one or other of the fighting American parties. There was no basis for it in Canadian politics, but people were joining whoever they met. The other thing that happened, so you had these two communist groups related roughly to the American parties. You also had a pro-Bolshevik current emerge in the Socialist Party of Canada. So when the May 1921 convention occurred, what it did was it brought together those disputing forces. The delegates to the original, that May 1921 convention, where one group from one of the communist parties, one group from one of the other communist parties, and two people who came from Winnipeg and Vancouver, Bill Moriarty and Jack Kavanaugh, who are members of the Socialist Party, left. So they were bringing together these different forces that had come to communism by their own different routes. And that what they called themselves was a party of a new type. And it was. There had not been anything like this in Canada before. And prior to 1917, probably the only place where there had been a party like that was in Russia. It will be, they said, this is from the workers, this newspaper, Workers' World. It will be a party of action seeking contact with the workers, a party in which the theorists and doctrinaires as such will find small place, a party of the workers and with them in their daily struggles against capitalist oppression, seeking always to build up a united front of the working class for industrial freedom and emancipation from wage slavery. Those who joined the new party were virtually all of the members of the Socialist Party of North America. The great majority, probably 95% of the members of the Social Democratic Party, and although you can't get figures, at least a majority of the Socialist Party of Canada. So this is this astonishing thing. That's how that came together. Now, what did they do? What was this party like? That's the second topic in the book. Very briefly, after overcoming what Joey mentioned, this undergroundism, the belief that if you weren't illegal, you weren't a real revolutionary. They headed out and did some amazing things. They played a leadership role in the 1920s in every significant strike in the country. There simply was not a significant strike in this country that didn't have communist involvement in it. They were particularly strong among the coal miners of Cape Breton and Alberta, among the lumber workers of Northern Ontario and British Columbia, and among the garment workers in Toronto and Montreal. They played a big role in building the Canadian Labour Party, which was not there's no organization like it today in this country, but it basically was an alliance of communists and social democratic labour militants to run in elections so that they wouldn't run against each other. They work out a common slate. They also were involved in many other campaigns, including one that has largely been forgotten and really needs to be researched more, and that was their work for women's rights and for the right to abortion and birth control, which were a significant part of their program in the 1920s. Florence Custance, who was the only woman on the original Central Committee, led that fight. At the same time, and I found this is, I think, truly amazing, the party stood alone in the Communist International as the only one that refused to support Stalin's campaign against Trotsky. No other party did it. In 1925, Bill Moriarty was sent as a delegate to a meeting in the Executive Committee of the Communist International in Moscow. He discovered when he got there that there was going to be a vote to condemn Trotsky. So he sent a cable back to Toronto. How should I vote? And the party's Central Executive Committee sat down and met, and they voted unanimously that he should vote against the resolution. They told him, among other things, that this campaign had not contributed to the attractiveness of the Communist International. And so he did, and he was the only delegate to vote no. So not only was this party playing a major role in Canadian labor struggles and other struggles, it was also a remarkably self-confident, politically principled party, and one that wasn't willing to be told what to do. Were they Trotskyists? No, they weren't. They didn't understand all the issues in the fight in the Soviet Union. They just knew there was something wrong with what was going on, and they weren't going to be part of it. And they refused to publish the stuff in their papers. Despite pressure from Moscow, for over 2 years they held out. That's topic number two, an amazing party in terms of its ability to work in the working class, in terms of a remarkable lack of factionalism, unlike the American Party, for example. When the American Party finally got together, basically everybody had been in a different organization before, just became a different faction inside the party. And then there was a group of people who thought there shouldn't be any factions, so they formed a faction to oppose all the other factions. Canadian Party had none of that. And that's not to say there weren't disagreements, often sharp ones. But during those early years, on the whole, it was a remarkably well, organization that worked remarkably well. Now, the third major topic in Canadian Bolshevik is the party's destruction at the end of its first decade. And you might think destruction is kind of a strong word, since there continued to be a communist party. But I don't think it is. Between 1928 and 1931, almost all of the Communist Party's founding leaders were expelled, including Morris Spector, Jack McDonald, Bill Moriarty, Mike Buey, and many more. And in that same period, three-quarters of the party's membership walked out of the party, just stopped paying their dues, went away. A new team took over, headed by Tim Buck, who had been the one party member. He was the one that basically carried out the next time he got sent to Russia to participate after Bill Moriarty. He was the next one sent over as a delegate. He didn't cable back for instructions. He voted for Stalin. His faction took over the party. They abandoned the program and the tactics they'd used in the 1920s. They split the unions, calling for red unions. As I said, they started calling all the social democrats social fascists. And they adopted this nickname, Tim Buck's Party, which is not a bad name for it, because it was a lot more accurate than Communist Party of Canada, which it really no longer was. And the Canadian Party, which, you know, in 1925, 26, 27, was one of the most independent in the world, after 1930 was one of the most servile in the world. You will search long and hard to find an occasion when the Communist Party of Canada ever disagreed with anything that came out of the Soviet Union after that transformation at the end of the 20s. So that's what the Canadian Bolsheviks is about. It's about the birth and death of a revolutionary party. And I think it's a positive story. I mean, it's true. Ultimately, that experiment did not go to where it should have gone, and we didn't get a revolution out of it. But it was the most successful thing we've seen yet. It was an organization with thousands of members. It led mass labor struggles. It was a heroic organization. It deserves to be remembered from that. There's things they did wrong that we can learn from it, and there's things that they did right we can learn from. But the main thing is we can learn from what they did. And we can also just remember our own history and not let it get stolen from us. I'm now working, some of you may know the name John Riddell, and John and I have started work on the next chapter. And that's what happened to those communists who were expelled, in particular Morris Spector and Jack McDonald, because they didn't give up. They joined together, they tried to build a new revolutionary organization in the 1930s. And so what we're going to write about next is what that next generation of revolutionary socialists did and learned. And I hope maybe in about a year or a year and a half, I'll be able to come back and talk about that one. Thank you again.